Is it time to replace your home's carpet or flooring? Call Sears Flooring to get shop-at-home convenience you can trust. Sears Flooring brings the showroom to you with a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, and laminate. And if you call right now, you'll save 20%. Call for a free in-home consultation at 1-888-491-3939. Sears Flooring has many styles to match your home and your budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring right now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring. You'll save 20% if you call now. Call 1-888-491-3939. That's 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Well, our second annual franchise legal series is coming to an end, as today's segment is the final one in our seven-part series. Expanding from four segments last year to seven this year has certainly been an exciting challenge for co-producer Joe Caruso and I, and we're thrilled by the positive results so far, as live and on-demand listenership is up over 40% over last year, and many of our guests are already talking to us about next year's series. Now, the feedback from the franchise community has been great, as well as we've received numerous emails referring to the great discussions about such relevant information affecting franchising today. The attorneys that have participated in the legal series are certainly a major part of the series' success. Their knowledge and experience in preparation for the series is definitely and mostly appreciated. Certainly the series would not be a success without them, but the series would also not be a success without my co-producer, Joe Caruso. Working with Joe last year, we were reshaping Franchise Today to be more pertinent and relevant to the franchise community. We had many, many brainstorming sessions week in and week out, sometimes hours at a time. Through this, it was Joe's idea to launch a legal series. Joe discussed the same with several franchise attorneys that he knows from the four or so FBN and Franchise Association meetings he regularly attends between New Jersey, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. All throughout, all thought it was a great idea, and many offered to be a guest in the series and or on future segments of Franchise Today. Well, the ball was certainly rolling and rolling fast. It's been a great partnership over the past year or so as the first series spilled over into making all Franchise Today shows more pertinent and relevant to the franchise community. It also led to including individual legal shows along the way. Listenership continued to increase throughout the year, and we are riding that high right through this year's second annual franchise legal series. We're already looking forward to next year's event. Today, I've again asked Joe to be here on Franchise Today. Joe, it's great having you on the air again, and I'd like to thank you again for all you've done with Franchise Today, and also to offer my congratulations on another successful franchise legal series. Thank you, and welcome on the show.
Well, Paul, it's been a great collaboration, and it's been my pleasure to work on this project, because the opportunity to deliver relevant content generally to the Franchise Today audience, and specifically with the legal series, is information that sometimes seems to be out of the grasp of a lot of franchise executives, and the opportunity for seasoned franchise attorneys that are experts in the area of franchising, and specifically the topics that we've discussed, have been terrific, and the information has been well received by evidence of the people that have contacted you and contacted me about what they've heard on the show and how it's helped them.
It certainly has been great, and moving forward, we anticipate a lot of great things on Franchise Today. Obviously, we'll have the legal series again in 2012. Hopefully, we might be able to even expand it to 8 or 10 segments, as well as have some other legal episodes throughout the year, individual segments. Of course, we'll also have some franchise finance segments. We are still working on a franchise finance series, albeit it'll be a two- or a three-part series at best. I don't ever see us getting to the extent of the legal series. We'll also be talking about, you know, of course, franchise sales and development, marketing, advertising, franchise relations, just a host of different things, but all with the focus on franchise best practices. That's what this is all about. That's what Joe and I talk about, you know, hours on end about. And it's something that we complement throughout our activity within franchise social media. And I think it's really gaining some traction. And I know, Joe, you probably agree on that as well.
Oh, I certainly do. And I think that thoughtful, caring franchise executives hunger for the knowledge to do things in a compliant way. They want to embrace best practices, and they really need the information. You know, one of my favorite shows of this this season and also last season was having Warren Lee Lewis on with the Franchise Seller's Handbook. The opportunity just to promote his handbook is worth the full value of the show. But then when you add in his commentary and his advice, it's invaluable information to a franchise or the executives within that franchise company, and giving them guidance on how to do things right and to grow their franchise systems and not be mired down in legal matters because they weren't selling in the compliant way. You know, one of Warren's best statements, I'll paraphrase, was, you know, I want you to sell a lot of franchises, but I also want you to be able to keep the money. And I think that's valuable information.
Sure, and I think I agree with you. Warren's two segments last year with respect to franchise sales best practices and all were centered around the Franchise Seller's Handbook was just fabulous information, very pertinent and very relevant, and really it can really be considered the foundation of everything else that we touched upon from a legal aspect. If we were talking about FPRs with Lane Fisher, which we did last year and this year, obviously it has a lot to do with franchise sales best practices. We talked with Leslie Curran last year, and then, you know, that has a lot to do with franchise sales best practices. No matter what we talked about in the legal series, it all seems to be on top of the foundation that Warren set. And I really look forward to seeing Warren again and having him on the show in the future, and I have no doubt he'll be on the show in our future, without a doubt. Also, I'd like to let everybody know that, you know, we had received a personal commitment from IFA President and CEO Steve Caldera to be on the show at least once a year. I think that'll be great. We're looking forward to a future show with Jack Earle, the IFA chairman. We had him scheduled a couple of months ago and ran into some technical issues, and then he's had a very busy schedule going to Europe and China, and we're hoping to circle back with Jack and get him to talk some about his visit to China, which I think is right about going on about now, or maybe they just got back. Moving forward, we'd like to introduce, you know, some franchisors into the scope of franchise today, strictly talking again about franchise best practices and what they may have done and be able to share with other franchise organizations. So all in all, I think it's been great. I really am excited about the interest in the legal aspects of social media. Lee Plave and Jonathan Redgrave have done a great job setting the table for future discussions about social media and e-discovery and all the legal implications that go on with it. So I really think the future for franchise today is going to be bright, and hopefully we'll be improving our platform and being able to provide some collateral and support material for our listeners as we move forward. And Joe, you know, today's guest is Michael Webster. And, you know, I recall that it was your marathon telephone conversations with Michael that was actually a big part of your inspiration for a franchise legal series. What are some of your thoughts behind that?
Well, Michael is a franchise attorney that is decidedly a franchisee advocate, but I soon learned that he's more of a franchising advocate. And in talking with Michael, as I often do, about similar topics that you and I talk about that revolve around best practices and what best practice franchising should look like, I was talking to him about the radio show, and I said, we really ought to have you on. And that was the spark, and that's what caused me to think, well, if we had Michael on, and we had him talking about his knowledge of franchising and information that franchisors could use and should use, we could have other attorneys on. And that really was, it was really as simple as all that.
And I think it's, and I'm not even going to say it's ironic, because I think it is a very prudent starting point that last year we started the legal series, and it really became the backbone of Franchise Today, discussing with Michael independent franchisee associations. And to me, I say it's prudent because it is really all about the interdependency of the franchise relationship, the sharing of information, the open communications, and diminishing the some of the control issues that franchisors, especially ones that have fallen by the wayside, seem to be so concentrated and focused on. And Michael Webster is an attorney, an academic, and businessman. He obtained his PhD in choice theory from the University of Waterloo in 88, and his external examiner was A.K. Sen, who is the Nobel Prize winner in economics. His JD in law is from the University of Toronto in 94. His commercial litigation practice is limited to representing franchisees, their associations, and dealers. He's a member of the Upper Canada Law Society and will pay a dollar to anyone who can satisfactorily explain why Ontario is Upper Canada. And we had some discussion about that last year, which was quite insightful. He's a member of the American Association of Franchisees and Dealers. It was the supporting member of the year in 2007. Member of the Year in 2008, and proud supporter of the Fair Franchising Standards Committee. Currently, he's the chairperson of the Strategic Committee at the new, and I say new, this is actually a year or so, the new at the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. He's dedicated to providing small business operators with the benefits of online network economics. And with that, Michael, I welcome you to Franchise Today again.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you being here on the show, and hopefully, as I said earlier, you and Joe have been known to have some marathon telephone conversations, as well as Joe and I have had some marathon telephone conversation, and as we only have 48 minutes left in the show, I think it'll be a challenge to get all of us to shut up at the same time and not talk over each other and run out of time. And we do have an interesting topic today, and one that I know you're passionate about, independent franchisee associations. And the question that I posed out there to the franchise community is, love or hate them? And this morning we received a kind of a pre-show commentary from, I think, a would-be listener, but certainly somebody that follows our discussions in the various LinkedIn groups. And this one was on the franchise social media group on LinkedIn. And it basically was in response to a comment to my posting about the show. And as Joe and I routinely do, we post the upcoming shows in about 20 different franchise LinkedIn groups. And this person responded, and I'm going to quote him. In my over three decades of involvement in developing franchises, I have witnessed many franchisors that look at independent franchisee associations with varied opinions. Some feel disdain, viewing these organizations as simply interference, while other franchisors look to these organizations as a tool to better unite franchisees. In reality, those franchisors who deliver little to the franchisees yet expect timely payment of their royalties are the first to balk at the interference these organizations present. franchisors who go the extra distance with franchisees are quick to tap into the enormous power these organizations can provide. A properly orchestrated relationship between the franchisees, the organization that supports them, the Independent Franchisee Association, and the franchisors will discover this is a terrific tool to use in growing the organization while helping to ensure a synergistic effort that the franchisor is working to develop. So I'd ask you, Michael, do you have any opinion on that? Or maybe a good place to start is actually defining the difference between franchisee associations and franchise advisory councils, and then work towards this statement.
Sure, Paul. I agree, this is an excellent statement, and I just say the only thing I would disagree is when the commentator says franchisors who go the extra distance. It's not an extra distance. It's the nature of franchising that you have to work with and coordinate groups of people that you don't have an employment contract with. And so the associations are there to improve the franchise system. And, the level of control that the franchisor may think they have because of their contract or agreement is largely illusory. You have to get people on board, and that's why you need a franchisee association. The difference between, and this, I have to be general here because there are some very good franchisee advisory councils, and there are some very bad independent franchisee associations. No, let's not kid ourselves. But the general difference is the franchisee advisory council is largely picked to be a sounding board to the franchisor who just wants an immediate reaction to some of his or her ideas. And that's, that's valuable. They have their that's an important role to have for the franchisor. Generally, these people are going to be far friendlier to the franchisor. I mean, socially friendly. It's you need people to bounce ideas off of, and you're generally going to try and bounce those ideas off of people who like you and are in your own social milieu, let's say. The franchisee association, the trade association, on the other hand, is there to help promote the entire franchise system. There are a number of things that they can do collectively that will help the system. One of the, as both you and Joe know, one of the large problems in any franchise system is the accuracy and timely reporting of profit and loss statements by the franchisees. Now, every franchisor has it in their agreement that these things have to come in on a monthly basis, and that it's a reason to breach, that breach is a reason to terminate the franchise agreement. However, that power that they have in the franchise agreement doesn't get them the benefit they want, and that is timely and accurate collective reporting. So you need a franchisee association to go out and push that coordination project for the benefit of everyone. It's not something that a franchisee advisory council is set up to do. It's something that a franchisee association is set up to do. They want to be able to, for the benefit of everyone, put together a platform so that franchisees can get the benefit of that collective reporting, and the franchisor can get the benefit. And there are two different benefits. But most franchisors have found that by simply requiring it in their franchise agreement is not sufficient. So let me stop there and get your reactions to that.
Joe, do you have a reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, what Michael has so aptly stated is a perennial problem for franchisors. Franchisors want that data. They get gross sales information. They might even be getting that gross sales information on a weekly basis if the royalties are remitted weekly by the franchisees. But getting information on a timely basis and in the format, in the chart of accounts that is useful and accurate, that's a very, very tall order. And to send your franchise business consultants, your franchise service consultants, the field people out and to beat up franchisees so that they report appropriately is something that franchisors really aren't very good at doing. And if the common thread between the Franchisee Association, the Independent Franchise Association, and the franchisor is that they both could benefit from this data for different reasons, because they're going to use it differently. But ultimately, metrics emerge from having this aggregated information that is helpful to everybody. And I don't know of very many franchisors. There are a few that do an excellent job of getting this information, but most people, it's setting your field consultants up to be dentists, and they're out there pulling teeth.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about for a second, Michael, the typical objections by franchisors with regard to engaging with independent franchisee associations. And then I'd like your opinion on that, but then I would also like Joe's opinion, as he's worked with a bunch of franchisors as well, and see if we can kind of compare some notes on that.
Well, I mean, everybody, when the ABA was up in Toronto a couple of years ago, Harris Chernoff and Roger Schmidt had a session on independent franchisee associations. And, the sessions are largely attended by franchisor side.
And I think we might have lost Michael's audio feed. Joe, are you still with us?
Have you got
me? I'm here, and I can hear Michael.
Paul, all right. Do you want,
keep Joe, talking, Mike.
What do you want? All right. The consensus among the franchisor side council was that a independent franchisee association was largely a litigation group, a group of people that were malcontents, wanted some systemic change, and were going to employ the adversarial legal procedure as the sole means of obtaining that change. Mm-hmm. And if I was a franchisor and somebody said, I'm an independent franchisee association and I want your job and I want you out of here, I'm not going to have I'm not going to like them a whole lot either. And many of these groups that start up as litigation groups, litigation by its nature has to be secretive. That's the nature of the game on both sides. So you don't even know who it is that you're speaking to when someone, sends in a demand and signs it independent franchisee association group. But they are, there are many franchisee trade associations that were not the result of litigation. KFC is the oldest well-known one. Roto-Rooter of America is another very old franchisee association. These were set up for entirely different reasons. Both Hardy system is an excellent example of a system that was set up because of the impending change of control when the franchisor of Carl's Jr.'s was looking to buy and eventually did buy the Hardee's chain, and had, I think as Joe will agree, delusions about the nature of the success of possibly converting all of the Hardys to Carl's Jr. And the Hardys Association was instrumental in helping that system, because they were able to gather data from their own failed conversion attempts in the past with Burger King and Roy Rogers, and get that to CKE in a form that they could understand and modify their own plans. Yes, there are some associations born out of litigation that have then gone on to work effectively well with the franchisor. The Meineke Dealers Association is the best example, but there are very few that have succeeded like Meineke has. I mean, Meineke succeeded so well that Ken Walker, the past president of the IFA, speaks very highly of the franchisor's reliance upon much of the projects that the Meineke Dealers Association have brought to the system. But there are not that many groups born out of litigation that have been as successful like the MDA. So if you're a franchisor and the only thing that you think of with respect to a trade association or a franchisee trade association is a litigation group, of course you're going to be concerned. But that is, you know, and if you're a group of franchisees wanting to improve your system, you should not at first, you know, align yourself with goals achievable only by litigation.
Joe, having worked with a number of franchisors, I know you've worked with various, you know, advisory councils and what have you. What is your opinion with respect to why franchisors today would be hesitant to engage with an independent franchisee association?
Well, my personal opinion over the past 20 years has evolved, to answer your specific question, I think that the major concern is the idea that the franchisees are gathering together in association with one another to wreak havoc against the franchisor, either in pointing out all the things that the franchisor is not doing right, or wanting to negotiate a rewrite of a franchise agreement, which there are examples of that happening in different franchise systems, and the genesis of the independent franchisee association is not about necessarily the betterment of the franchise system, but it's about showing the franchisor what for, and I think that's their biggest fear, and it's really a fear of the unknown. They don't know what they're going to do. And franchisors are stuck. They don't know whether they should help them create a good franchisee association, or they should be standoffish. And while they may be required to recognize them, they aren't required to engage with them. So I think that they there's so much misinformation and there's so much imagination of all the things that could happen. They're not really focused on the benefits. And I think those create a lot of fear.
Right. You know, I had the distinct honor of, well, let me back it up a second. As many of our listeners know, I've actually run a couple of large franchise organizations in the non-food service sector and was instrumental, and this is going back 18 years ago, and I was instrumental in helping to form one of the company's first franchise advisory councils. And of course, at that time, as your opinion has evolved, my opinion has evolved as well, Joe. at that time, I thought that it would be great to encourage franchisees to participate and help in some of the decision-making process, because I've always been a firm believer in the interdependent franchise relationship, and have never been a proponent of some of the control tactics that franchisors have exhibited. And I thought an advisory council would be great, especially as we were turning the corner in our organization and had a lot of aggressive growth initiatives on the table. Well, as fortune would have it, where I was honored, I became a franchisee and became a multi-unit franchisee and assisted in a lot of training of other franchisees and working with them. And I was had the honor of being elected to the Franchise Advisory Council as a representative by franchisees. So now I was on the other side of the fence. And the honor came when I was elected president of that advisory council, and now was sitting, in essence, at times on the other side of the table with the franchisor, now, of course, representing franchisees. But at the time, I never really gave thought to an independent franchisee association, because now I do understand the difference between the two. But I think maybe what we need to do is, because I think there are a lot of people in franchising that might really not understand the difference between a franchise advisory council and a independent franchisee association. So, Michael, if you would, can you kind of just explain some of the differences that might be very obvious to you, but to some of our listeners, especially a lot of our upstart franchisors, might not really understand the difference?
Sure. The Independent Franchisee Trade Association typically does the following. It runs its own convention. It provides its members with a benefit package that you know, might be in health benefits. It may be a POS, depending on the system. It may be some outsource in human resources. There's a series of benefits that it provides it to as a condition of membership. Depending on the system, it may have an interaction or with the systems co-op. All of the YUM, for example, all of the YUM associations have a interaction with the YUM branded co-ops. But it need not be the case. Some, like Subway's Trade Association, does not have a clearly identifiable connection with the Subway Purchasing Co-op. So they also provide education through the website, and they provide advocacy on issues that may be that the franchisor has no interest in pursuing one way or the other. One of the most important functions of any good franchisee association is to provide communication and information about compliance. How do you comply with this law in order to minimize your costs and make sure that people who are not compliant are maximizing their costs? So, you know, getting correct understanding of the legislation, state by state or federal, that's extremely important. None of these functions are necessarily associated with any franchisee advisory council, because the council itself is likely a collection, is not set up to promote those four functions, that is, member benefits, communication, advocacy. Those things are probably, for most councils, dealt with on a more ad hoc basis. Could a council develop into a real trade association? Sure could. And the, you know, the other benefit of a, depending on the association and how it's run, is that if you have members in the association who are also sitting on the purchasing committee of the franchisors, if you're a vendor, and you're not being able to go through the front door, let's say, you're able to go through the side door and talk to those franchisees on that purchasing committee and, you know, get more of a chance to sell to the entire franchise system. Mm-hmm. And so it's a much more well-defined vehicle, and it's, you know, has in common many, the Franchisee Trade Association has in common many aspects of any nonprofit association. Whereas in a Franchisee Advisory Council is usually a sounding board. It may have elected members, but it doesn't have the scope that a trade association does, nor is it attuned to providing those goods and services that would be a benefit to the entire system, but the franchisor does not want to provide for fear of stepping over the control line or vicarious liability. I mean, a good, you know, training, for example, on HR issues, there's, you know, that's right now every franchise system has to be worried about whether the local state is going to come after them for essentially being an employer. I mean, the reverberations of the Coverall case are still being heard. Any state that needs money will look at a large franchise system franchisor in their state as a potential for payroll taxes. And the franchisor's stuck, aren't they? They have a problem. They have a real dilemma. They would like their franchisees to engage, let's say, in best practices with respect to workers' compensation, but they can't demand it. Huh? So, but an independent franchisee association can come in, organize, provide those best practices with respect to, say, workers' comp to the franchisees as a benefit of being a member of the association. So the franchisor gets the, you know, the benefit there of they get best practices. They're not going to be, they've lowered their franchise vicarious liability, both on with respect to common law and with respect to probably statutory obligations. And they haven't done so by increasing control. They've done so by allowing a group of franchisees to understand that if they could outsource these best practices, do it through an association, that is, you get those access to that those services by being a member of your independent trade association, that benefits everybody. And if there is one and only one reason why a franchisor would be interested in a franchisee association, it would be to reduce that liability and get the benefits as if they had, you know, demanded or controlled those best practices.
Very interesting. Joe, from your perspective, can franchise advisory councils and independent franchisee associations, based on what Michael has just told us about both, can they really work and play well together?
I do. Let me react first to what Michael just said and the general apathy by some franchisors to want to engage with or even have independent franchise associations. I think oftentimes when a franchisor executive or president or owner of a franchise company hears the word independent, they hear the word adversary. They interpret that word as adversary, and there's going to be some kind of dispute or fight. And what they really ought to be hearing when they hear the word independent is separateness. And there is a value in separateness. And Michael did a great job of describing that value, because if the independent franchisee association is organized as a legal entity and it is absolutely separate from the franchisor, whereas most franchise advisory councils are essentially an arm of the franchisor and are they don't have that separateness. I think that there is a value, and I call it a value of separateness, and I think it's important to be able to mitigate the vicarious liability and at the same time get those services to the franchisee, the unit level franchisees, for their benefit and also to the benefit of the franchisor, because those kinds of compliance issues, the ones that are really kind of hands off, that where the franchisor would be exercising too much control over its franchisees, would be addressed. So I think that's a terrific explanation by Michael, and that's kind of my thoughts on individual, independent franchise associations. Now, in terms of franchise advisory councils and independent franchisee associations, I think they can coexist. And I haven't seen this done, but I think a novel approach could be that a franchisor have a franchise advisory council, engage with an independent franchisee association, and maybe even have a nexus between the two, and maybe have somebody that have a seat on the Franchise Advisory Council that's occupied by a designee from the Independent Franchise Association in some capacity. They may actually be an officer of the Franchise Advisory Council, or they could just be a designee that is invited to the meetings and is a nexus between the two groups. I think that could be beneficial. Some independent franchise associations may want to be entirely separate, but I think that could work for some franchise systems.
You know, certainly we can, continue or actually start a debate on, who should be members of both, et cetera. But, Michael, I'll turn to you right now. You know, what are some of the independent franchisee association best practices, and maybe I rephrase that, has a best practices regimen emerged at this point that for franchisees and franchisors to follow for guidance?
No, I think that one of the difficulties if you're starting a franchisee association from scratch is that what's probably, got you together is you're deeply annoyed at some part of the business model. And that deep annoyance is not a reason to continue an association. It may be the starting point, it may be the genesis. But you have to look to those, four pillars that Steve Ellerhorst has, described in great detail on our site about how that association provides communication channel, how it provides a member benefits, how it provides advocacy, and how you're able to get the new vendors into the system. Those are your overall goals. Those four pillars, if you're able to, and there are a number of different ways depending on your system to achieve those goals. There is no, simple cookie, simple one easy manual to put out there for you. There are a number of things you can do wrong right off the bat. If you decide to form an association and you want to instantly achieve credibility by collectively bargaining with the franchisor, I suggest that that'll be a long time in coming. Your first goal as a beginning franchisee association is to actually get some credibility within your own franchisee community. I mean, who are you guys? Why would my business be better if I were aligned with you? Now, there are a number of excellent associations that you could attend their conventions and learn what it is, something about their history, how they dealt with the particular problems you know, the AAHOA convention that's coming up in, I believe it's Las Vegas this year. It's usually in Chicago, but that's a terrific trade convention to attend and talk to some of the executives and council. There are a number of associations that have huge, very large trade conventions, and you'd be well advised to, if you were beginning, to talk to some of those people. I know the CFA is trying to put together a, with their group of 8 or possibly 9 franchisee trade associations, some understanding of what has produced results for them as a group. But, you know, the reality is that history counts a lot. History counts for a whole lot. And every trade association is likely going to find themselves with a different set of problems to solve. So I don't think a best practices other than don't do the following. there's a lot of things. You know, one of the things you just have to understand as an association is, you may think that the franchisor's business is a terrific business to be in. And if you really think that, you should get out of your business and go into that one, right? But don't come and say, your business is so great, we'd like to share it. We'd like more of it. Why would that be, why would that be an appropriate business response? You wouldn't go to your supplier and say, geez, what a great business you're in. Could you give me some of it? Right? They would laugh at you. Now, if on the other hand, you went there and said, I have a solution that will help you sell, help me sell more of your stuff to our consumers. Well, yeah, now you're getting someone's ear. But if you'd simply go, as many beginning franchisee associations go and say, your royalty rate is too high and I can't make a living, or your advertising is always the thing that attracts a great deal of attention, your advertising is ineffective, so I want to spend it. I don't know anything about advertising, but I want to spend it. Those are non-starters. Those are going to get you nowhere, and they should get you nowhere. Those are not serious proposals. If you go and say, look, it doesn't appear to me that we have enough empirical data on the validity of our advertising. Could you show me how we're doing that and what you think are best practices with respect to that advertising? You're going to get that's a serious response. That demands a serious response. That's a very useful starting spot. Or if you went and said, look, it appears to me that we need far more training on A, B, and C. I've lined up these vendors who've got a training budget. I think we can get them out to regional meetings. Will you work with me on that? That will get you a serious response. That's something that a lot of franchisees don't understand. The suppliers themselves not only have advertising budgets and rebate budgets, they have training budgets. All sort of falls under marketing, and you can access those training budgets. Why? Because if you're a supplier and someone comes to you and says, look, I'd really like to use your product, but I'm afraid I don't know how to use it. Will you provide some training? The supplier is going to say, of course I will. Can you meet me tomorrow in St. Louis?
Well, going along with the topic of today's show, independent franchisee associations, love them or hate them, I would imagine that a lot of franchisors fall into the latter and hate them, and probably hate them because of the unknown. Have there been certain circumstances that have occurred where franchisors have put their back up at the thought of or even the introduction of a potential franchisee association? In situations like that, I mean, how do you overcome that without it becoming a legal battle?
There are many. If I'm hearing you right on this, Paul, there are. I would point to two associations that started off with legal battles and then came to and have come to different levels of interaction with their franchisor. Meineke was born out of the failed class action over the misuse of advertising funds, the Meineke Dealers Association, and largely as a result of very skilled counsel, excellent leadership by that association, terrific executive directors, they have developed into a very fine working relationship. Now, of course, there is always going to be, difference of opinion, conflicts over economic goals. But as I say, when Ken Walker, the former president of the IFA, lauds his association, if I'm a franchisor, I want to know a lot more about why and what sort of association Ken Walker thinks was valuable to the Driven Brands system. Then on the other hand, you have, a group, the Dairy Queen Association, born out of litigation. And as far as I can tell, and I'm farther away from it, and I'm sure some of my franchisee attorney friends will chastise me for this, but it appears to me from looking that they've continued to manage by litigation. And I just don't think that that's a viable route either for franchisors or franchisees. So the association that's born out of litigation may go one of two different routes. It may continue with that litigation mentality with respect to management, or it may go the Meineke route. I want to be clear on this. The Kentucky Fried Chicken Associations and the corresponding group of franchisees that control the advertising fund for Kentucky Fried Chicken, they just went through some litigation. There's nothing wrong with going through litigation to try and understand your respective rights and responsibilities. I would, however, point out that as a result of that very expensive litigation, both sides were essentially told by the chancellor in Delaware, you guys ought to work this out, right? Mm-hmm. You ought to think about this a little bit more. I mean, it was a very polite language and lovely language indeed, and showed a great deal of insight into the social dynamics of the litigation. And I highly recommend everyone read the judgment. What it comes down to is you may not like your franchisor, you may not like your franchisees, but you have to work together for the next 15 or 20 years. And the franchisor has to understand and respect that as a group, the franchisees have far more collectively invested, far more at risk than the franchisor is. The franchisees have to understand that they have a duty as interdependent businessmen to work to promote the system, even sometimes at their own individual benefits, and that the franchisor is not their employer. The franchisor does not have a proven business model. The franchisor is providing some scale effects. They have to provide the other ones. And there is nothing that will kill a franchise system quicker than for the franchisees to throw up their hands and expect all of the solutions to all of their business problems to come from the franchisor. That's just a simple, simple mistake.
Well, you know, looking at this, as many franchisors would immediately say, oh, God, I hate independent franchisee associations. I would never have them. They're nothing but trouble. They're born out of militancy, a lot of disdain. There's, you know, questions about the royalties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we know the negative comments that a lot of them have made and will make with respect to independent franchisee associations. So all that aside, a question I'll ask to both you, Michael, and Joe from a franchisor's perspective, why should franchisors love independent franchisee associations?
I don't think they should love them. They already have them, whether they know it or not. You can't get together, you know, 200, 250 people working in a business without there being cliques, groups, and informal associations already forming. If you're a franchisor, you want that to be organized in a way that you can get that coordination working for you. So I don't know if you love them or merely understand that they will be there and that you need to communicate with them. And having an independent, as Joe correctly pointed out, understanding the value of that separation, having a way of directly dealing through a separate corporate vehicle, your franchisor issues. That's extraordinarily valuable. So,
Joe, let me, because we're going to be running out of time here in a bit, and I'd like to just get Joe's perspective on that real quick. Joe, are you still there?
Love and hate are interesting terms, and they make for catchy titles. And we got to get people to listen, so we always want to put a catchy title out there. But Michael is correct in pointing out that there is a tribal organization of franchisees, and they can be large groups and small groups, but they are together on things, and they're talking about things. And I think wise franchisors should look to institutionalize to a degree these cliques and these groups so that they become a force for good in the franchise system. I think there are myriad benefits to both parties for doing that. Will the franchisor ever love them? No, because sometimes it's going to feel like that independent franchise association is sticking a red-hot poker in your eye. Because, you know, sometimes you don't do things right when you're a franchisor, or you're not competent in every area that you'd love to be competent in, and the last thing you want is having some franchisee group telling you that you're doing a bad job. But if you can get over that and look to those things as being constructive to the franchise system, and you recognize that there's a payoff for that because you're a franchisor and you make money on royalties, and if there are more royalties, that's good. If the franchisees' businesses are more efficient, you get more franchisees, and hence you get more royalties. Those are ways of using an independent franchise system and loving the idea of institutionalizing the tribal activity that's happening can help you build a durable and sustainable franchise system.
Very well said. Well, Michael, thank you again for being our guest today. It always amazes me how fast an hour flies by when we're having fun, and we are almost out of time. And I would like to invite you back again because I know from the preparation and our notes, we do have a lot more to talk about. And I know there's different things you briefly mentioned about scale effects and stuff like that. I know we could probably talk for 2 hours at least. So I would like to extend that invitation again to you.
Oh, I appreciate it. I think that, to understand, the scale effects and network of networks and platforms is critical for any franchise, anyone in the franchising world.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again.
And I just want to get one last endorsement in here for anybody who wants to understand the sociology or what Joe called the tribal nature of franchising. Read Peter Berkland's Franchising Dreams. Terrific, terrific sociology. Wonderful to understand.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for letting us know. Joe, thank you again for all you do and for helping to make Franchise Today a leader in franchise media. May I remind our listeners, as you're on Facebook, Franchise Today is also on Facebook. And be sure to like us and look forward to future episodes of Franchise Today and look for Joe's continued collaboration and assistance in making Franchise Today even better tomorrow than it is today. Thanks again, Joe.
You're welcome.
Have a safe and happy Memorial Day weekend. Until next week, I'm Paul Segreto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.